Hello, and welcome back to the Pagan Podcast. I know it's been a very, very, very long time since I've made an episode. About a year now at this point. But I wanted to jump back on to the Pagan Podcast and just talk about what's been going on for this past year. Not so much the entire year as a whole, because I have a very big episode planned for this episode, and we're going to be talking about the Celtic paganism as a whole, and hopefully I can get all of this into one episode. It is a lot though, like it's a lot, but basically I've been on a hiatus because one, I've been focusing on myself, work, school, all that, working on myself and my craft as a self-identity thing, because it's been kind of a struggle, to say the least, just finding out what I am, not so much what I am, but what I want to follow, and being consistent. It's really hard for me at this point. I'm not very consistent. I've been on this like roller coaster of like this journey of everything, kind of, not just paganism, Norse paganism, like witchcraft, eclectic witchcraft, Buddhism, like a whole lot of stuff. I've been up and down all over it, researching, discovering new things, finding new things, getting interested in something, researching that, finding something else, researching that, seeing what I like, finding something completely different. And then following that lead, it's just been like a maze, and I haven't been like on one solid thing in like a year, pretty much, since the last time I made a episode on here talking about Norse paganism. Because after Norse paganism, and I made that like, you know, discovery, more or less, I kind of just decided that I was that. Not so much that I, basically I didn't know what I was doing. I just kind of labeled myself, researched something, gave it a go, and then called it a day. So, honestly, I kind of feel pretty guilty about that, because one, I should have done more research, and I should have just stayed researching and being eclectic and keeping my mind open to a wide range of things, because one, paganism is a huge spectrum. Like, there's a lot to research. There's a lot of stuff in here, and it doesn't stop at just one thing you label yourself. That's one thing I knew about paganism. A lot of people say just don't jump into labels, because like there's so many things. Like, you can be a sea witch, you can be a green witch, you can be eclectic, you can be a like a celestial witch, you know, focusing on different things. And you can just focus on small things. And then, I mean, I got into Norse paganism, and then I'm looking into Celtic paganism. That's what this episode is about. And I'm not labeling myself anymore as any particular thing. I'm just going to research a whole bunch of things, give as much knowledge as I possibly can find out there, and then keeping an open mind on all of the other types of things that are out there, because there's a lot, and it blends together sometimes, as I've seen researching Celtic paganism and how it has influenced, or was a big influence, for Wicca, and how that whole thing happened. And then there's things before Celtic paganism. There's a lot. So with that out of the way, I'm going to dive into the script that I've made for today's episode, which is going to be a very, very long, long episode. So where do we begin? So, who were the Celts, and what was Celtic paganism or Celtic mythology, and where did it originate? So, there was a story that went that two gods were born of the same womb, formed the same woman, and the goddess of the sea. And the two brothers were gods who left the sea to live among the people on the land. And the reason why we know this story, and it's so like prevalent in the Celtic like mythology or religion, is because of how old it was and how it was passed down from word of mouth for ages until it was finally written down by a man traveling from the Mediterranean. And it was written down by the Greek historian Timaeus, whose works were later found by Diodorus, I believe that's correct, I don't know. But anyways, Diodorus had heard or written or read the works by Timaeus, who had written these stories down by word of mouth, or had heard these, written them down, and then Diodorus read them, and then he wrote them down as well in his own way. So this is like a secondhand, thirdhand account for this story. And what's great about the fact that a bunch of people wrote this down is, one, there's a lot of people who heard it, passed it on, heard it, and then passed on again, even though it could have been changed a couple times, you know, throughout the way of the down the line. But the reason why it's important that Diodorus wrote it down was because the works that Timaeus wrote did not survive, and the only accounts that we have are from Diodorus, who had wrote them down, and then they had been passed down throughout the Celtic generations. And now I just want to talk about who were the Celts, or who were the Celtic people. They were some of the most feared people in ancient Europe that lived mainly during the Roman times in places such as Spain, Britain, Ireland, Germany, Italy, Eastern Europe, and like Eurasia. It was a very vast area, like the Celtic people. They were in a big area. So when we say like Celtic religion or Celtic mythology, there's a lot, like there's a whole bunch of different practices in Celtic people that we can't even pinpoint certain traditions being to a certain area because it's just so vast, and there was not that much of like resources, word of mouth, because people in the Celtic like era, they didn't write down things. It was all spoken and passed down from word of mouth. And the people that did write it down were people that were of secondhand accounts. They were Roman. They were Greek. They didn't have more or less of like a belief in this system. They just wrote it down from their account or from their like perceive. Like they wrote it down from how they perceived it. And that was either in a bad connotation, or it was in a satire connotation where it's like, I don't really believe this, but I'm writing it down because this is history or whatever, this is what happens, or this is who I believe the Celtic people are, or this is what I've seen of the Celtic people, or this is what I've seen them do, you know. And they wrote them down as they were feared, or they feared them. They were strong soldiers who were fighting against the expanding empire of Rome, and they taught tales of reincarnation. And they partook in religious sacrifices of human people, and they offered them to the gods. They killed animals. This is what's being written down, at least. They're writing it down in a negative connotation as saying these are like barbaric cannibals who sacrificed humans and animals and did all these sacrifices and were very like rugged people that would fight in war, and they were to like be feared for this, which, I mean, at the time, I could see how this would be like a good thing for them trying to expand and take over Rome, because, you know, you'd want to be feared if you're trying to take over an entire continent almost. But it was written in a way that makes them kind of seem like they were bad people, or like the opposite of what they would probably write about themselves, as more of like courageous, outstanding heroes, or like someone to be respected for their like the things that they've done throughout their lives. But Rome obviously did not like them because they're trying to take over them, and they are trying to take over the Celtics, you know, that's how that goes. Anyways, the farthest dated telling of the Celtic people was when we heard it from the Celtoi, told by Greek merchants and explorers around the Mediterranean and Atlantic area during the time period around 500 BCE. And then eventually the same Celtic people who were there inhabited the places of Gaul, which is today's modern France, and they traveled all over occupying Italy and Greece, And these stories of the Celtic people would go on to be written about famous Greeks, such as the Greek historian Xenophon and the philosopher Aristotle. And they talked about the Celtics as being amazing warriors, courageous people in battle, and they would like dive right into the fight wearing nothing but gold tirks around their necks. And that was one of the only things that I had found that had like portrayed them in kind of like a good way. And I'm not so sure how like factual that piece was. Let me just look at the book real quick just to notate where I'm getting this information from. And it's from the book, I believe it's Celtic Mythology, and it's from Freeman Philip. Just wanted to drop that in there just because I'm not sure how factual it was that they had given a good connotation to the people. Anyways, so the Celtics were very well known for their battles and their victories and how courageous they were and how feared they were. And they had taken over Italy and the city of Rome in 390 BCE and would bargain with their enemies for gold in return for their safety and then destroy the land, conquer it. And it was said that they were chieftains and they would keep the skulls of their enemies as victory trophies displayed for all to see, and in hopes that they would make them afraid, which I'm sure that it did. And this was recorded by the Greek philosopher Poseidonis, who visited Gaul, which is now France again, at the beginning of the 1st century BCE. And the Celtic descendants went all over the Balkans and later invaded Greece. I'm not sure what I was supposed to say there. Sorry. And then even going as far to what is now Turkey and invading that, and what is now the Galatians. And they were known for having a very strong relationship with their gods, and they would love to tell tales, sing their songs about their stories. And while the Celtic people of Gaul were eventually overthrown by the Roman Empire, which was ruled by General Julius Caesar, some key parts of the Celtic religion were preserved through the Roman conquerors, but they were inscribed and passed down from word of mouth and written in a negative connotation, like I said previously. And some of them were some of their traditions were adopted by the Romans and then taken, manipulated, kind of switched, but not like they kind of made it their own and said, we own this now, this is how we do this, you know, kind of adopting it, taking it, you know, and making it their way. The one thing that they changed, obviously, was the human sacrifices by what were the Druids. And I guess they did this to prove, they're better than the Celtics, how the Celtics would do their human sacrifices, their animal sacrifices. And that was one of the main things that the Romans said was barbaric, not okay, not human. I mean, to be fair, it wasn't awesome, but that was one of the things that they pinpointed as being one of the things that they wanted to make as a negative connotation for them. And sadly, there are no records of the Celtic people being found directly from the Celtic people. They're all from secondhand sources or third-hand sources coming from other people that have witnessed these accounts or have witnessed hearing people talk about these accounts. So we don't know what the Celtic people actually would have said about what their actions were. Anyways, let me continue. The Celtic people just lived their life without any need to record or write down their myths and stories. Instead, they had directly passed them down from their word of mouth to others of their descendants. And then, sadly, Caesar was brutal and continued to conquer and eventually took over the Britain Celtic people, in particular, practically vanished their religion or destroyed their religion altogether. But the language and telling of the gods had lived under the Roman people until it was practically gone forever. And this was thanks to the Saxons and the other Germanic tribes during the beginning of the AD times. There were still some parts of Wales and Cornwall in Britain that were very Celtic and had their religion very heavily, and they kept it alive. And this is why today most of the surviving tales are from Wales or around Wales and our famous Welsh tales in the Middle Ages, such as the Mabinogi, I believe that's how you say that. And such tales were of magic giants, aura giants, and then elaborate stories of supernatural powers, great kings, which played a heavy role in shaping the European literature around that time. And the only part of the Celtic culture to remain virtually untainted by the Romans was in the Free Ireland during the first century AD times. And this was partly because Ireland was known for being a far out land, savage island that was crazy and had cannibals and was just very sophisticated. So it was just left alone, untainted. Whatever they did, they did. They didn't really want to mess with them because they just felt like they were on a different part. They were unsophisticated from everybody else. And this is probably why the Celtic religion is known very well for being Irish, because it prospered there. And the land was actually very fertile and prosperous for farmers. And these farmers sometimes had Celtic tombs and monuments from ancient Celts, giving the land a very rich culture of the Celtic religion. And they could see these monuments, these areas where people would do their sacrifices, their rituals, their practices, and they could just, you know, feel that history in the land, see it and feel it, touch it. You know, you can still go and see all these today. Like, that's just one of the places where it was just so prominent there. And there's numerous monuments. Like, you can go all over and find different ones, but like, that was just one of the places, and that's why it's like super known to being an Irish, you know, religion. But Celtic is very vast. Like, you can go to Scotland, Wales, Cornwall, like Germany, probably. There's like a lot of places, even like France had some. Brought up Gauls, you know, there's a lot. But anyways, let's talk about Christianity now, which is a big part of this, because Christianity had a very big influence, or more so, they had kind of tainted it in their way of recording things down. So Christianity eventually reached Ireland during the early 5th century AD because of the bishop known by the name of Palladius, sent by the Pope Celestine to minister the people of Ireland. And the reason we know this is because of the boy who was captured during the Irish slave raid on Britain, and he was named Patrick, and he was a Roman nobleman, and he had escaped and returned back as a missionary with the new religion, Christianity, and the skill of writing, which gave him an upper hand and a Christian influence on his writings of what the Celtic religion was. And it had been written down by people with an outside influence for numerous years, not just the Christians, but the Romans also and the Greeks. And they used their own words to kind of give it a different message, basically. So you can't really take everything as fact, but more or less you take it as, this is a general idea of what happened in like that time period. And these people, like I said, they only either watched it being practiced or they heard from another account of what they had practiced. And however, it was still a very big key part of this history, because without those people, we wouldn't know as much as we do about the Celtic religion as we do today. And the Irish people eventually would write down their Celtic tales as they know it, but Christian tales as well. So there was a mix between what they would write their Celtic tales, keep their religion alive, but they would also write down Christian tales during that time, because Christian was a very big influence in Ireland during that time period, as they were trying, or the Christians were trying to transition them into the Christian faith. However, fortunately for them, they did not, and they stood firm in their heritage and their faith, and they kept it alive. The only problem is these were recorded as myths by the Christians, and the word myth is debated a lot, either being its equivalent to the word false, while as the Greeks, they would say it simply means a story spoken by word of mouth, given and passed along. That's what the word myth meant to them. And another problem with that is that myths and tales, especially for the Celtic tales, they were recorded by authors that were not alongside the original tale or didn't keep it as factual and whole to the actual truth, is if that makes sense. Basically, they heard it from another point of view, heard it from another account, wrote it down in their own words and their own ideas, you know? So they kind of blended it together. And some were rude to the Celtic faith, of course, using their own nuances to change or affect the messages coming across because they just simply didn't believe it. Or they just wanted to change it because they knew that they were believing in this new faith and that this one should obviously be wrong because they have this new one, you know? Or that's what they've grown up with knowing. And one very famous scribe who was Christian wrote this that I find very interesting and was probably common during the time period of all the scribers who would write down their interpretations of the Celtic religion. And it says, "I, however, who have copied this history, or more accurately this fable, calling it like a story, give no credence to various incidents narrated here. Some things in this story are feats of devilish deception, others are poetic figments, a few are probable, others improbable, and even more invented for the delight of fools." And basically, hold on, let me take a drink real quick. How it's like portrayed is basically blatantly saying that these are works of fiction recorded by him as a devilish in nature to those who read them and are merely invented to delight us, but definitely couldn't be true or very improbable at the least, some things being possible but most likely improbable, and are just there to be a nice story to hear for the reader and just not actually believe. And I assume that this is what happened a lot when the scribes would write things down that they heard or stories that they had heard told as far back to the day of the Twin Gods. If the stories were not written down by the actual Celtics or the persons who practiced them or spoke them or the actual group that would rehearse these daily practices, I feel like it should be taken with a grain of salt because we can't know for 100% certain that any of these things were 100% true. Nevertheless, we still look back on them because that's the only account that we have of these stories existing at all. So I just wanted to keep going on with the, it's just like they kind of, the Christian faith was mainly to be followed by like the Romans, and they would, you know, or Ireland, it was just like this growing thing. And things got manipulated and misconstrued over the centuries, over time, all the time. Like, it wasn't a new thing, it wasn't a new facade. And the Romans believed that the Celtic people were wild and barbaric, and that they would use their own judgmental view and their reasons to conquer them, to write these down in a negative connotation. Same with the Christians using what they know as their faith to be true, to write these stories down in a negative connotation because they know these to be false because of their new found, you know, belief system. And the last thing I want to bring up about that is that these things told to us by these people are merely their own perceptions of the Celtic people and probably very far from what the Celtic people themselves would actually say or describe about their own faith if they had preserved what they had done and written it down. And moving on, so what do we know about the actual Celtic religion and the Celtic gods? So I was reading and I saw the line in the book, and it said that Julius Caesar wrote some of the most important parts of the Celtic faith, regardless of his negative connotation. And he writes it in a satire way. This can't, like, he says that this can't be real. It is still fascinating what he says, and I'll read it now. "They wish to insulate this as one of their leading tenets, that souls do not become extinct, but rather pass after death from one body to another. And they think that men by this tenet are in a great degree excited to valor, the fear of death being disregarded." And that's kind of like a weird like translation of it because, you know, it was written years, centuries ago. But basically, what's interesting about that is that they believe that the souls of the human body, and of one, when someone dies, their soul or their energy doesn't go away, but merely reincarnates into something or somebody else, and their soul goes into something else while their body or their life form like disintegrates and they move on to a different, like a different realm, and their soul passes on to something else in the current realm. And another good video or piece of evidence or like more research to back me up on this is a video by The Wisdom of Odin. And he made a good point saying that basically the Celtic people believed that your body, once you die, the soul stays and goes into something else while your body goes into a different realm, instead of like, you know, with the Norse paganism, you have Valhalla, and with like Christianity, you have like heaven and hell, and like other places, you have like a higher and a lower. It's just a different realm in a different area, and they go into that, and the soul goes on to a different, like, body or different person. And another thing that Julius Caesar said about the Celts was, all the Gauls assert that they have been descended from the gods, or the god Dis, and say that this tradition has been handed down by the Druids, which is a very important key phrase, like very important. Like, I know he's probably saying it as like this sounds stupid, but like that's very important for anybody who wants to actually learn about the Celtic religion or practice the Celtic religion. He says that all of them believed that they had descended from the god Dis, and that this tradition had been handed down by the god, or the by the Druids. And here's a blurb from an article that puts what Julius Caesar said or did about the religion in a better way than I can recite it. So it says, as well as naming Dis, Caesar used the convention of giving Roman names for the rest of the gods as the Gauls, and described Mercury as the chief deity, as well as Apollo, Mars, Jupiter, and Minerva. As war is perhaps the least satisfactory arena in which to study cultural anthropology, this is probably a very rough and unreliable overview of the reality of the Gaulish religion. After all, this was an era where even the Romans were confused about their own gods and religion. To contemporary intellectuals, such as the followers of the 4th century BCE Hellenic philosopher Plato, gods were scientific expressions of universal phenomenon, not to be taken literally, in the time at least. To the masses, they were a literal truth, an unseen power made visible and understood through images and ceremonies. Religion was diversifying at an alarming and unsustainable rate, and his appraisal of the Gauls and the contradiction he makes with the German tribes in chapter 21 in the book that he wrote, where he claims that they had no druids and worshipped only what they saw, which was the sun, fire, and the moon, have underpinned the study of European paganism ever since. But it is likely that the Gauls, Britons, Irish, and Germans probably shared very similar beliefs with the which the Mediterranean mind found it difficult to conceptualize. And so what I want to take away from that blurb there is that obviously the Romans had a very heavy influence on the Celtic religion, and they heavily Romanized the Celtic gods and goddesses, so what we know about them is heavily jaded from the Roman view. But with that being said, there is a lot of similarities that the ruler Caesar had made about the Celtic gods to the Roman gods and the Greek gods, which is very notable. And I want to also say, we don't have a lot of concrete knowledge of what the pre-Roman, pre-Hellenic religion amongst the Iron Age or the Celtic Germanic tribes was really about, or what the gods actually stood for. But what I find interesting is that the god Dis, or the god that Julius Caesar had talked about, was viewed as a conductor of souls, or the guardian of the earth's fertility of life, who lets souls fly from one body after death to return to another existence of life form. And that is very interesting, because of the law that Einstein had made of the law of conservation of energy that states that energy can neither be created nor destroyed, only converted from one form of energy to another. This means that a system always has the same amount of energy unless it's added from the outside. And that is, I don't know, it's just a cool scientific fact that I wanted to throw in there. And basically, to at least Julius Caesar and the Celtics, this disc god or entity was the most notable or totem god for the religion. But I was reading the article that discussed this, and it mentioned that Julius Caesar attempted or made an attempt at showing the Romans the similarities between them and the Gauls due to the fact that some of them owned Gaulish slaves during this time period and wanted to, I guess, upscale the Romans, you know. And I wanted to go on and say, so the Roman god Mercury, who was Hermes to the Greeks, he was also a, I'm probably going to butcher this, psychopomp or conductor of souls. And it said in the article that one reason why Caesar would have used the name Mercury in Dis or like Hermes for the Greeks, as well as others like Mars, Apollo, or Jupiter, was to refer to them all as the same important divinity and connect the Gauls to the Romans in some way. So basically, like, those are all in some way the same kind of person, or they represent the same thing. They're all conductors of souls. Another piece from this article I feel like I should recite from the actual article directly is, the core domestic and plebeian religion of Rome was, after all, based upon ancestor spirit worship, or lares and genial, as well as lemures, larvae, and manes, and veneration of the eternal gods, Jupiter, etc., was generally seen as a more high-minded and public affair, albeit open to fads and trends, an imperial decree. The Romans' beliefs in disincarnate souls therefore showed a distinct commonality with the Celtic neighbors, and is in evidence among Romans' Etruscan forerunners. Basically, it just says it better than I can portray it. But it was obvious that the Romans had adopted some of it, if not taken some of the Celtic religion and transformed it into their own at some degree, being it as they had their similar gods or similar people that they would represent as the Celtic gods, which was like Mercury being a conductor of souls. And it also states another interesting statement about fairies during the Christian times and how during these times the ideas of disincarnate souls that were of pagan ideas or origin were identified now as fairies and spirits. So like the disincarnate souls are, they were being transformed into fairies or spirits that inhabited an inverted parallel world. Basically, their day was our night, and our night was their day, and it was, and vice versa. And it said that this was, or this went on to become a cultural shibboleth of the Atlantic Celtic people. So another type of Celtic people. And now I want to dive into the fairies real quick. So this piece is from the Eric Edwards Collected Works, and it states in this brief blurb, in Irish mythological tales, fairies are referred to as the Tuatha De Danann, and their origin is assumed to be derived from ancient goddesses, priestess, nature spirits, nymphs, druidesses, and the fates, making the fairies and the Tuatha the descendants of primordial gods and goddesses. And this was in a time where the Celts were still pagan and following a very pagan type of craft, and what influenced, you know, Wicca during that time period. And they depicted fairies in a very different type of way than what we've seen in the 19th century, where they had like wings and all that stuff. These fairies were simply without wings and just had the supernatural ability to fly. And that's how they were depicted. Another excerpt from the same article, and it's by Stephen Forth. I don't know how to pronounce that or say it, but the links and everything will be in the bio of this episode. And it says that the tales of the Tuatha De Dananna, I can't say that right, go back thousands of years and was translated as tribe of Danu. And they were a race of people possessed incredible, almost godlike powers. According to the legend, they ruled Ireland from the early 19th century BC until the end of the following century. And this tribe was defeated by the Molossians. So they fled into the Scythes underground. After that, they became known as the, I'm going to butcher this again, Deoin Scythe, and had children with the likes of Fionn Mac Cumhail, also known as the Eosai. And these underground people became smaller over the generations, turning them more like fairies. And the tales of these diminutive figures is the line of where the Celtic tradition of believing in tiny people were forced into hiding by hordes of invading humans, you know, bigger people. And other figures such as the Pooka are also possibly from Celtic pagan times. And the Pooka is associated with the, I say it's Samhain festival, but I've heard it said other ways, but I just say it's Samhain. If that's wrong, correct me. Anyways, it is said that in post-Christian era was where it began to get, we began to get stories and legends of the Banshee and the Leprechaun, who was also a fairy, or it was probable that it was. And another part of the Celtic religion on fairies is that the fairies had a realm that they shared with gods where they never aged and avoided death, which is pretty much the reason why I wanted to bring this up in the first place. And it was said that it was located in a place called Tirnanog, which meant the land of the young. And it said that in an article that it was believed that this realm was located in the hollow hill where the Tuatha De Danann was forced to flee, and was a magical portal that allowed gods to come in free as they went, and the fairies. And there was a lot of types of fairies, but I'm not going to get into that right now because there's too many to discuss. But I want to go on to say more about, like, what I've researched about the Celtic practices and more or less of the, like, historical coming of the Celtic people and more of what they actually most likely did during their era. So this excerpt is, it states, they maintained rich spiritual practices such as prayer, meditation, communing with nature, and care for those in need, hospitality, poetic use of their imagination, and art. They saw in all experiences the presence of the spirit, and they were very skilled at seeking encounter with God in all of life. And then what did the ancient Celts actually worship? So they had numerous gods that they worshipped, and they would worship them in sacred places such as lakes, rivers, cliffs, and bushes. And these areas were called groves or sacred groves. They would also worship the moon, the sun, and the stars, and they were especially important to them. And then the Celts thought that they were also of supernatural forces in every aspect of the natural world. And what the Greco-Romans said about the Celtic traditional practices, which is also important because it's a notable reference to the actual time period of what might have been done or what might have been seen done, because we don't know much about the actual practices from first-hand accounts. And it was said that the Celts would make sacred groves and natural shrines for worship called nematons, and some Celts would build temples, ritual enclosures, and some would do offerings and sacrifices for the gods of treasured items deposited in water or sometimes wetlands and in ritual shafts or wells. And it is said that the Celts believed in certain places having a spiritual importance, and these were typically amazing trees that were like very big, or some mainly oak trees because they were like denoted as sacred oak trees. And those were called robur, which I have linked to an article in here. Or they would worship under mountains or near mountains or rocks or stone circles that they would make. or druids in lakes and rivers. And at those places, they would perform rituals, prayers, offerings, and sacrifices of sometimes human or animal. And they were usually existing structures, or sometimes they would worship in existing structures that were just unexplainable or that they deemed sacred in nature. And now to dive into what the sacred groves were. And sacred groves, as they're defined in paganism, are sacred patches sometimes of primal forest in rural communities that are protected, and they are used to worship deities. They could be by bodies of water near a patch of trees. And what makes it sacred is the feeling of the energy or the need to make an offering in that area, that spirit, like the spiritual presence. They would just denote these places as a spiritual high-end energy area where they would give gratitude to the deities, they would worship, perform rituals, do their sacrifices, stuff like that. And with that being said, I think I've said a lot on this topic, but there's still so much to cover. But I'll get into that more when I do some more research, make another script about so much more of the Celtic paganism, like, path, follow back into the Norse paganism path, a bunch of eclectic paganism, and how Wicca, you know, came from the Celtic religion. Just dive right into all of it. It'll probably be brief at first because there's a lot and we could go on for hours and hours and hours, but anyways, with that being said, I really, really hope you enjoy this episode on the Celtic religion and all of its origins and what they actually did as a people of a group and what they actually practice as far as we can tell in history. But yeah, that was a lot, and I really hope you enjoyed it, and I will see you guys next time.